And it's interesting when we say, okay, 15 minutes a week of porn, that's an addiction, but the 3 hours of TV that the average American watches per day is not an addiction.
Justin Lay Miller, a science-backed sex researcher, social psychologist, author of the blog Sex and Psychology, as well as his most recent book, Tell Me What You Want, which offers an unprecedented look at sexual fantasy based on the most comprehensive study ever conducted. And today, Justin discusses the reality of sex research. Namely, that public commentators of sex and the associated psychology tend to be from a place of personal experience and not evidence and facts, and we discuss some of the issues that this brings. We also delve into the anxiety around deciding your long-term lover or partner that many young people tend to face nowadays due to the huge success and choice of online dating. However, Justin attempts to break the very common negativity surrounding new technologies and dating, and instead raises some very clear positives, such as the increased diversity within relationships. Justin also talks on a subject that is clouded with misinformation and fear, porn usage and addiction. We uncover some of the realities of this topic and how that could affect porn users. And as a last point, I highly recommend that you check out his book, Tell Me What You Want, if you are truly looking for some science-backed information, and I will be including the Amazon link in the bio, as well as the link directly to his website, which also offers some bonus material if you choose to buy from there. So, with that in mind, please welcome Justin Lay Miller.
Mind-bending chemicals.
I don't care, he wants to kill me.
I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
That's a good question. And I've been running my blog, it's called Sex and Psychology, for about a little over 8 years now. Mm-hmm. And the reason I started it was because I wanted to provide a place where people could go for science-backed information on sex, love, and relationships. And there are certainly lots of advice websites out there, but what I found is that most people are speaking from their own personal opinions and experiences. And certainly I think anecdotal advice and information can be useful. There's a place for that. But the danger in relying solely on one person's experiences is that it might not generalize to those of everybody else. Mm. And so I think that's why it's really important to try as much as possible to let our understanding of sex and relationships be informed by data and research. Mm. And if you're going to make decisions in your own sex life or relationship, I think it's probably best to try and do that based on what the data say. So that's what mm-hmm. I really try to do on my website is root everything in scientific research. I provide the sources and references for all the information and studies that I talk about so that if people want to learn more, they can. But I try and do a good job or as good of a job as I can of digesting that material for readers so that they can get the key points and take them away, but also at the same time understand the limitations and the nuance in the data, because mm-hmm. data is always messy.
Yes.
And there's a lot of individual variability, and the fact that there is so much individual variability is another reason why it's important to not put too much stock in one person's experiences, mm-hmm. because we're all very different people mm-hmm. when it comes to sex and love.
Yeah, I was gonna say, like, this is sort of a plight of all of science to a certain degree, right? Sort of other people coming in and I guess saying things that are different to maybe the experts are, and I'm sure a physicist can say something similar. But I think it is important to note that in the world of sort of sex and relationships, this does happen more so than other fields where people sort of are saying that they're experts or they have the right answer. Why do you think this is sort of a subject matter that attracts it more than others might?
Sure. I mean, everybody thinks they're an expert on sex and relationships because
maybe that's it.
Almost everybody has sex and relationships. So they feel like they have something to contribute in that way. And I totally get that. And like I said, I'm always happy to hear and I'm fascinated by learning about individuals' experiences and observations of the world. And I've learned a lot that way. But
of course,
I think having the aggregated data and looking at what the general patterns and themes are in the data is really important and valuable.
Mm-hmm. And sort of on the flip side of that as well, to the point that everyone has sort of experience with it, I have no doubt that it also makes things difficult for you as well on a delivery basis, because I imagine a lot of people might get emotionally sort of averse or attached to the answers that you might have. So is there sort of any things that you have in mind? Are there any ways that you particularly try to deliver pieces of information that might be sensitive, or that you can sort of foretell that people are going to have a hard time digesting?
Yeah, so I spent the first 10 years of my career as a college sex educator, and right. I taught human sexuality courses at several different universities. I've kind of moved around a lot for personal reasons. I taught at Colorado State for a few years. I taught at Harvard for a few years. I currently live in Indiana, and I've taught here at Purdue University and Ball State University. And one of the things I found in teaching college students in different parts of the country who have different political leanings and religious leanings is that I need to be as inclusive as possible in the way that I present all of my information. And I always need to think through what are the ways that different audiences are going to perceive what I'm saying. And so I try to make an effort to make what I'm saying be as accessible as possible to a diverse audience, because everybody wants to know more about sex and relationships. And so it is a challenge, but I think it's something that I've learned how to do pretty effectively, is to be able to speak to the data and to be able to do that for a diverse audience.
Yeah, I suppose it is important, again, as we were talking about, because it is something that affects everyone in a different way that I think arguably any other science does. You know, even you can discuss things in medicine that you'd say would affect us all because we're all human, but not everyone maybe has the same disease. This is one of the few things that it actually does hit everyone sort of on an equal level plane. And I suppose for yourself as well, have you found that over your sort of career, obviously you're doing research, you're finding out new things before other people find out about them. Have you found that it sort of influenced the way that you, look at people around you, at society as a whole? Has it even influenced the way that you have tackled your own relationships and things?
Absolutely.
Really?
I mean, so I think it's, when you look at my history, I grew up in a relatively small city in Ohio, which is in the Midwestern United States. And I grew up in a household where we didn't really talk about sex. I went to Catholic schools for a lot of my elementary and middle school. I also went to Catholic colleges for my bachelor's and master's degree. And so I was someone who was just never exposed to, let's say, comprehensive sex education. So when I got to graduate school, working on my PhD, I was assigned to be a teaching assistant for a human sexuality course. And as part of that course, I had to lead a weekly discussion section with a group of 20 to 30 students who were asking me all of their questions about sex. And I had no idea what the answers were. So I had to go look up and research all of these things that they were asking. And I actually found that a lot of their questions didn't have answers that were based in the data and research, because it turns out there aren't a lot of sex researchers out there. And it's very hard to get grant funding to do sexuality research. So our knowledge base is limited in a lot of ways. And that's part of what inspired me to want to become a sex researcher, is I want to fill in the gaps in our knowledge so that we can all lead happier, healthier sex lives and relationships. And certainly I take what I've learned through the research and, to whatever extent possible or relevant, apply it in my own life. Because I think there are lots of things that I still have to learn because I was just never taught much growing up.
I've recently spoke to sort of a contemporary of yours. You might be aware of Kristen Mark. And we were having a conversation too about the fact that what you just mentioned there, that there's really not many sex researchers. It's extremely difficult to get funding as well, which is obviously the bread and butter of all sort of scientific research. And she obviously laid out a few of the ideas and thoughts of why she thinks that is. Why do you think that is? Especially in the US, you know, there seems to be more so than I think where I was born in the UK or even in Australia, there seems to be so much sort of divide across the country when it comes to how liberal or how at what age sexual education begins, how comprehensive it is. Why do you think there's so much divide, and why do you think still in sort of 2020 we're having this discussion of how much education is correct?
So it's interesting that I live in the United States, which is a culture where sex is all around us in the media and in advertising. And a lot of people from the outside look in and think that America is this hypersexual place, right? Because we're constantly surrounded by all of the sex. But there's this interesting paradox where we're surrounded by it in the media, but we're not allowed to talk about it, right? Mm. Because sex is still very much considered to be a taboo. And there's a lot of shame and guilt and embarrassment and anxiety that's tied up in sex and sexual desire. And what we see is that people feel more comfortable having sex than talking about sex, right? Which is kind of weird because sex is like the most intimate thing that you could do with somebody else. But so many people just kind of go into it without really communicating about what it is that they want or asking what it is that their partner wants. And so we've got this communication problem that is preceded by a shame and anxiety problem that's preceded by sex being this taboo. And so it's a multi-level issue where there isn't a simple, quick, easy fix for it. You know, certainly American attitudes towards sex have liberalized over the years.
Definitely.
For example, you can look at Gallup poll data, and Americans' attitudes towards sex today are the most liberal on record. They have the most permissive attitudes toward casual sex, toward divorce, toward having children outside of marriage. And, you know, most people say they're accepting of these things, but there's still so much taboo around talking about sex openly.
Why do you think it is like that so much in the US? I actually haven't been to the US, so I might just be talking nonsense, but I feel like comparatively it is more, there is more turmoil around sex than there might be in some other nations. What do you think the roots are? Is it just from the time of the formation of the US, the association with religion? Is there something else under the surface? What do you think?
Certainly the roots of this are very deep. You know, the United States is a puritanical culture.
And,
you know, if you sort of trace the history of religion in the United States and religious belief systems, it makes sense that we're going to have a lot of this baggage when it comes to how we feel about sex, how we talk about sex, how we view it in terms of being moral versus immoral. And so I think so much of it is tied in with the broader cultural history. And like I said, we see this evolving over time, but it's evolving at a very slow and gradual pace. There are certain points where we've seen rapid changes happen. For example, when it comes to acceptance of same-sex marriage, right? It wasn't that long ago that a large majority of Americans disapproved of same-sex marriage, but now it's the reverse. And that happened in a very short period of time.
It's interesting.
But when you're looking at sex more broadly, most things don't change that quickly in terms of people's sexual attitudes.
And do you think there's some sort of like, I suppose the best way to think of it, some sort of ceiling to a certain degree? Because obviously the work that you're doing is you're trying to, trying as if you have like an ulterior motive, but you are doing things that will sort of change the attitudes of the general public. For the greater good, right? It maybe encourages greater sexual health, more confident relationships, longer, happier relationships, things like that. Do you think that there will be some sort of ceiling in terms of the fact that humans just sort of will have a certain amount of uncomfortableness with sex that will just sort of prevent sex ever really being a point of normal discussion, something that people can be comfortable with, something that you can actually get funding for easily?
Yeah, and so it's also important when we're talking about all of this to recognize that the US is a very diverse country, geographically and politically. And so there are certain areas of the US, if you look at some of the larger cities in some of the more liberal states like New York City or San Francisco, where they are very sexually open cultures. Mm-hmm. And where you have large and booming sex club businesses, for example, that are above ground, they're not hidden in the shadows mm-hmm. and dark alleys and things like that. But at the same time, you also have some very conservative states where any open talk about sex is not looked favorably upon, and where any sort of sex-related business could not operate freely out in the open, where there might be ordinances that would restrict their ability to even work as a business. So, it's when looking at the overall country, we also have to recognize that from state to state, city to city, things look very, very different on the ground.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's obviously what maybe a lot of people who could be digesting your sort of material forget as well. Sort of if they're in quite liberal bubbles, they forget that probably huge swaths of the country have completely different ideals to themselves, right?
Absolutely, and also when people visit the United States and they only go to the really big cities like New York or Los Angeles or San Francisco, they might get a very skewed idea about what sexual culture is like in the United States. It's sex is a very local thing here in terms of the attitudes toward it, people's behaviors. But I do find in my research that sort of across the political spectrum, everybody wants to know more about sex. They're curious about it. And there's a lot of diversity in sexual interests across that political spectrum. And interestingly, if you look at some of the data, Americans, whether they're Republicans, Democrats, Independents, most of them want comprehensive sex education for their children in schools, right? So we're actually on the same page about a lot of things. So the political divide isn't as big as you might assume that it is, but for some reason that's not translating into action at, say, the federal level for mandatory comprehensive sex education across all states.
Mm-hmm. I suppose that's a good way to at least try to look at it is the fact that all people just want what's best for their families, what's best for themselves, what's best for their kids, and it might not actually be as divided, just maybe some of the finer details might be divided. I also did want to sort of mention, too, a couple of things from your blog, because there's so much good stuff to read. And it also ties in well to how some of these bigger cities have changed over the years. And especially there's a new thing that we're sort of all contending with, which is the internet and the sort of phenomenon of internet dating. And one of the blog posts that I read maybe a week or so ago of yours, which was sort of like the idea that you've almost got like a fear of missing out with internet dating, right? because there's so much availability. There's Tinder, Bumble, whatever else there is, and also it suddenly gives people who work an extremely busy life, who don't have any desire to go to bars or something like that, it suddenly gives them the opportunity to sort of date in a way that maybe they couldn't in the past. But speaking from personal experience and speaking from experience of also friends as well, I feel this sort of fear of missing out thing in a weird way that I've never predicted would sort of be the case. And I have friends who have seriously had issues with it, and to the point where they've met people that they've seriously got along with, and they just are unable to stop sort of that constant and consistent chase. So I suppose a good place to start with this point is this something that you're sort of concerned with, that maybe the face of dating is going to be something that is unnatural potentially or potentially harmful to the progression of relationships over time as this becomes even more normal?
So there are a few things that I think are worth mentioning here, and one is that if you look at the number of Americans who say they believe in the idea of a soulmate, which is that one person who's out there for them, that is their ideal in every way, that's going to meet any needs they have now and forever, you find that more Americans today believe in the concept of a soulmate than they did in the past.
Wow.
And interestingly, it's actually millennials and younger adults who are even more likely to believe in this soulmate concept. Mm-hmm. And I think that is part of what is informing the way that people are approaching online dating, where they're looking for the perfect partner, right? They're looking for that ideal. And when you're looking for this ideal and you have unlimited, endless options, it's like, well, where do you stop? Mm-hmm. You know, it's sort of getting in this mindset of the grass is always greener. There's always somebody who could be a better match for my needs. Because in any relationship, you're going to find that everybody's got some peccadillos and some things that irk and annoy you. And there is no such thing as a perfect partner. And so if you're looking for perfection, you're probably never going to be satisfied and never end up in a relationship. And so I think it's really important for us to reset the way that we think about relationships right. and stop looking at it as destiny. And there's just this one person that's out there for you. And instead, look at it through the lens of there could be any number of options out there that might be a good fit for you, but it takes some work to make any mm-hmm. of those options make for a sustainable relationship. And I think mm-hmm. if you adopt that perspective, it makes approaching relationships a lot less daunting, right? Mm-hmm. Because if you're talking about there are how many billions of people on this earth and there's only one person out there who's yeah. right for you, that's like a really terrifying concept.
Absolutely.
Because how do you know if you're going to find them? And maybe you already found them, but you left them, right? You know, that's a problematic way to look at relationships. So I encourage people to have what we call a growth mindset when it comes to relationships, where you recognize that conflict is inevitable. It will happen sometimes, and that relationships grow and evolve over time, and they can become your ideal if you work and invest in it. Mm-hmm. It's not just going to automatically happen.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like this is sort of a, that's honestly really surprised me, because when you started the sentence saying, it's sort of changed for millennials, I thought it was definitely going to be opposite, that people were sort of the wrong way. And I'm sure I'm not alone there.
I'm surprised by it too, honestly.
Well, that's the best thing about your job, I suppose. Yeah. So, you know, you mentioned this sort of growth mindset, but how do you sort of, on a deeper perspective, how do you think people should be sort of contending with this? Because at the same time, people obviously naturally shouldn't be in a relationship that's obviously destructive, or in a relationship that's obviously just not right for them, sort of without expecting you to be the sort of crystal ball predicting the future for literally everybody who's listening, where's the middle of the road?
So I think it's important for everyone to kind of do a little reality check on thinking about what is it that they actually want in a relationship partner, and then taking a step back and saying, why do I want that? Where mm-hmm. is that coming from? And I think when we start analyzing a lot of our wants and preferences and ideals, we can see how they've been shaped by our culture. They've been shaped by our religious upbringing. They've been mm-hmm. shaped by our parents. And so we have all of these different sources telling us what we should want when it comes to a relationship, right. and not as much about what is it that you actually want from your relationship. Mm-hmm. And so try and start by thinking about it through that lens. You know, where do all of these wants and desires come from? And are they actually the things that you want?
Yeah, true. I think that's a good perspective to have, to sort of in a human's existence for more things than just dating as well, is really sort of trying to self-analyze a little bit. Mm-hmm. Now, are you concerned at all about... because a lot of what we're doing with the internet and with online dating and stuff, a lot of it obviously is uncharted territory. It's getting more and more popular. It's becoming more and more of a sort of experiment with more and more people, right? Are you concerned about sort of other issues sort of arising from this sort of new way of dating coming that we might not have contended with in the past?
So certainly both sex and relationships are changing a lot as we develop all kinds of new technologies. And I think it's hard to predict exactly what is going to happen the future is going to look like. But I think we also need to be mindful of the fact that while there are certain challenges mm-hmm. that these new technologies pose, there are also a lot of great advantages mm-hmm. that they offer. And we have to balance the positive with the negative here. So for example, when we talk about online dating and sort of this paralysis of choice that a lot of people experience, you know, yes, that is a negative side effect of the fact that, we have all of these options around us. But a positive of having all of those options is that we're seeing a lot more diversity in the types of relationships that people are pursuing. So as online dating has become more popular, we have more Americans who are in interracial relationships, who are in relationships with partners of different backgrounds, religiously or politically, right? So we're seeing a lot more diversity there, where people are kind of going outside of their bubbles. And you know, I think arguably that's a positive thing, that Absolutely. That people are willing to step outside and experience something new and different, and that can enrich your life in so many ways. So it's, you know, again, sort of balancing the positive with the negative here. And I'm one to say, you know, we shouldn't be afraid of the technology, because
of course
there are negative things and there will be unexpected, unanticipated side effects. But rather, let's look at what are the potential good things that can come from this as well. You know, and if we shift to looking at, say, sexual behavior, you know, there's a lot that's been said and written about how the rise of virtual reality porn and sex toys are going to push people away from their partners and decrease intimacy. Well, let's think about the ways that they can actually promote and enhance intimacy in relationships, and how they can increase, for example, people's ability to explore themselves and find out what they do and don't like, how it can give people a way to engage with their fantasies that they might not previously have been able to do, or how these technologies might, for example, help somebody who has a physical disability to engage in stimulation with a partner in a virtual world that they can't have in the real world, right? So there's all kinds of considerations to take into account here.
It's quite refreshing to sort of hear that, because I feel like in this sort of particular sphere, we could talk about other parts of science where it's quite positive when we talk about the future technology, maybe medicine, things like that. But in this particular sphere, it does usually seem to be painted in a negative light, right? It does usually, almost always, I mean, I genuinely can't think of a time where I've read something that's gone, oh, this is actually a good thing. It's usually talking about the issues associated with sort of more casual sex when it comes to sort of apps and things like that. It's often talking about the fact that we're going to become more, I suppose, cold, like you just mentioned, and separated from one another. But it's actually quite nice to listen to you talking about that. And in my own experience as well, with friends and things like that, that just like you've said, they've ended up dating someone who from a completely different background than theirs. And to me, that is extremely positive. Hopefully seeing a future where people are sort of out of their bubble and they don't have to grow up in their small town and not that it's always a bad thing, but meet the person that they've known since the age of six and have the same thoughts and ideals and beliefs. So it's nice to hear something a little bit different. I've recently been reading a book called At Home, I believe. It's by the author Bill Bryson. And what's interesting there is he talks about sort of things in the home and how they got to be the way they are, why they're there, things like that. And he discusses parts about the bedroom, and it sort of shocked me about the breadth and the depth of the sexual fantasies that were occurring in eras that you thought people had, you know, lights off, completely, procreational sex. So I guess, how have you seen the idea of sexual fantasies change over your time, or even from things that you've read from past papers? And I suppose, is it for the positive, or is it for the negative, or is it just a natural transition?
So I think a lot of people look at, say, internet porn searches today, and they see all of this kinky and inventive content that people are looking for. And they think that basically the internet has broken us when it comes to sex. It's turned us all into perverts. And, you know, we're into the kinkiest and most extreme things now. However, if you look at the history of sex, you'll see that a lot of these things that we're looking at as kinky now, these are not new behaviors. You know, and one example of this would be BDSM. A lot of people like to say that, you know, something like 50 Shades of Grey and that phenomenon popularized BDSM and really stimulated a lot of people to want to try it. But actually, if you look at human history, you can see examples of BDSM that trace back decades, centuries. You know, this is not a new behavior, dominant submission play, sadomasochism, have been going on for hundreds, maybe thousands of years. So I think it's important for us to not just look at everything and say, oh, the internet caused this, and because we can mm-hmm. find it online, that's where it came from. No, these things have much deeper roots than that. Unfortunately, we don't have reliable data on sexual fantasies at different historical periods to say, okay, exactly how have our fantasies changed mm-hmm. over time? I wish we did. The data of just course. Don't exist. So, you know, I can only say based on artifacts and other things that we found historically that line up with some of the things that people are doing today, that a lot of these things are not new practices, and that mm-hmm. for as long as humans have been having sex, they've been having kinky sex.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the way you're sort of talking about it there is it's almost like a philosophical reflection, like an anthropological reflection, you yeah. know, it's actually something about what makes us human. I guess, you know, I don't expect you to be an evolutionary biologist or something, but what is why does that exist? Why is the role there? I mean, I don't really know much about sex in the rest of the animal kingdom, but it seems like it's something that's quite specific to humans.
Sure. And so evolution certainly does play a role in shaping our sexual fantasies and desires. Mm-hmm. And I very much consider myself to be a biopsychosocial researcher, which mm-hmm. means I take into account the biological and evolutionary factors that influence sex, as well as the psychological and the sociocultural factors. Because you can't just look at sex through one lens, because mm-hmm. all of these different factors come together to influence us. So if you want to talk about evolutionary biology and how that might, for example, shape sexual desires and fantasies, there's some really fascinating research on the concept of what's called sperm competition. And mm-hmm. the basic idea behind it is that when you have men who are in situations where there are multiple men competing for the same female partner, we have the argument there is that we men have evolved to become more aroused in those situations and to change their behaviors in ways that allow their sperm to outcompete those of other mm-hmm. men. And mm-hmm. so many evolutionary psychologists have used this sort of framework to explain why men are, say, more interested in group sex than women okay. are, and why men have more gangbang type fantasies than mm-hmm. women do. And they've actually conducted some fascinating experiments to back it up. So for example, wow. there was a study where they had men masturbate to one of two different porn clips. One featured an all-female threesome, and the other featured two men having sex with one woman at the same time. And men masturbated, they collected ejaculate samples from both of them. And what they found was that men released more motile sperm. And when I say motile sperm, I mean sperm that are active and
operational
is cool, a good, yeah. good word for it. They released more operational sperm when they watched the video with two men and one woman compared to the video where it was three women all interacting. So that supports this idea that maybe we've evolved in ways that have shaped our sexual fantasies and desires.
Wow. I mean, I must say sex research is it's a tough job. It is one thing that's got to be said.
And maybe now we understand why it's hard to get funding for it, right? Because yeah. You can see easily how politicians could say, well,
oh, absolutely.
We're giving these people money to show porn to college students and have them masturbate. That is immoral. That is wrong. Right. So it's very easy for them to paint the work that we do,
of course,
in a very negative light. And mm-hmm. I have several colleagues who have been awarded grants by federal agencies to do sex research who have had members of Congress on the floor of the House of Representatives making speeches about why their specific study needs to be defunded, because
wow.
it is a waste of taxpayer dollars, it is immoral, and the government has no role in doing that. And so that is part of the issue that we have when it comes to sex research, is that it's just so controversial.
It's a hard sell.
Yeah.
It's a hard sell, especially to the wrong individual. You know, it's one thing sort of telling me the ins and outs of a piece of research to me, but to a board of sort of people who have grown up in a certain existence and who are maybe 60 plus years old and whatever else, it's an absolute battle, I can imagine.
And that's why it's much easier to get funding to, say, study STDs, because you can make the argument that this is in the interest of public health. we can save on healthcare costs, all of these other sorts of things.
Yeah.
So that's where the money is, because it's an easier sell.
Okay, that makes sense compared to sort of pleasure-based studies and things like that, right? So the other thing I think that's worth mentioning, because we've obviously just spoken about the, I guess, the evolutionary roots, the what it is to be human roots of these sort of sexual fantasies and likes and dislikes. You've also had a couple other posts on your blog about sort of the evolution within oneself of what someone's sexual fantasies are, what they like and what they dislike. What are some of the sort of considerations, and what are some of the major influences to an individual that then dictates what their sexual fantasies and what their likes and dislikes are?
So what I find in my research on sexual fantasies is that our fantasies are very much related to our personalities and our own sexual histories. So I published a book a couple of years ago called Tell Me What You Want, that is based on the largest and most comprehensive survey of sexual fantasies in the United States. And I surveyed more than 4,000 Americans from all 50 states, wow, ranging in age from 18 to 87. And they completed a 369 question survey. The 69 was not intentional, it just kind of happened. But I asked people about what they were fantasizing about, the who, what, when, and where. I asked about their personalities, their sexual histories, their demographics, so that I could look at not just what we're fantasizing about, but what our fantasies say about us. So some of the key things I found were that our personality traits are related to a lot of our sexual fantasies. Okay. So for example, if you're a very extroverted person by nature, you're very sociable and outgoing, you tend to be much more extroverted in your fantasies. You have more group sex fantasies, more non-monogamy fantasies. For example, if you're somebody who is more neurotic, meaning you don't deal well with stress and you have more emotional highs and lows, those individuals tend to play it really safe in their sexual fantasies. Okay. They're not venturing out and trying new things. They're not having group sex, because those things can be stressful, right? So instead, they're thinking more about fantasies where they're getting some comfort or reassurance. I also find that in addition to our personalities, our sexual histories are linked to our fantasies. So for example, the activities that took place the very first time you had sex are disproportionately likely to be represented in your current sexual fantasies.
That's interesting.
I also find that there are connections between pornography consumption and fantasy content, not just in terms of the activities you fantasize about, but what the bodies and genitals look like of the partners in your fantasies. So our fantasies are this very complex product of our own individual psychology, our accumulated life experiences, and then on top of that, our evolutionary biology and our culture. So I think when you're studying sexual fantasies, it's one of the most complex things you can look at in sexuality, just because it's so multi-determined. And two people could have the same fantasy for drastically different reasons.
I mean, that's an interesting point, that the first time a person has sex can actually influence what they think about sex and what they like throughout the rest of their life. And I suppose, again, in terms of the argument for sexual education, it's important for people to have positive experiences the first time they have sex for this reason. And also sort of on the, I suppose, darker side of sex as well. Again, referring to one of your blog posts and something that I spoke to, again, Kristen about, and something I've just thought about as well, is sort of the role with, maybe sexual trauma, also the role, specifically from your blog post, you were talking about people that had fantasies of sort of forced sexual interactions, either receiving that or even the next blog post you had of being the one sort of perpetrating that. These sort of, I would say, darker parts of sexual fantasies, are you concerned of the sort of medical implications, the psychological implications that this might have on a person, or are you happy sort of for these sexual fantasies to be quite free reign, as it were?
So if we talk about forced sex fantasies, I think most of them are not something to be concerned about, because when you start peeling back the layers and looking at how those fantasies are playing out and how people are describing those scenarios, they are fundamentally consensual sexual encounters. And that's why a lot of people don't like the term forced sex fantasy, and they don't like the term rape fantasy. And instead they use the term consensual non-consent, because in the fantasy, you are in control of who your partner is, exactly what happens in the encounter, how far it goes, when it stops, all of those things. So in these fantasies, the fantasizer is empowered. And a lot of people go to great lengths to say, you know, maybe I'm providing token resistance and saying, I don't really want it, but I really do. Or, you know, my partner says they don't want it, but they really do. You know, so they're making it clear that I don't want to commit sexual assault. I don't want to be sexually assaulted, but I just want to play with power and dominance and submission. And so for that reason, and through that lens, I would say that most of these fantasies probably aren't something to worry about.
Right.
Where it does become something to worry about is when people legitimately have a non-consensual fantasy and they truly want to force themselves on somebody else, whether that's an adult or a child. And when you have intense recurrent sexual fantasies about committing a non-consensual act, that's when it's time to seek help, because there is a risk of acting on it, breaking the law, harming somebody else, and that's where it becomes a problem.
And is there sort of a relationship between those who have had sexual trauma in the past and how that sort of influences what they, what sort of sexual fantasies they have? Is it more likely that they will have a fantasy such as this? What was it called? A consensual, non-consensual consensual encounter? Or does it tend to go the other way, in which, like you said, people who are more sort of introverted prefer sort of a bubble of safety? Is there trends with this? Or
so what's interesting when I look at the correlations between experiencing sexual trauma and current sexual fantasy content, I see some inconsistent correlations that emerge.
Right.
So, for example, I find a link between people having been sexually victimized and having more BDSM and forced sex fantasies. I suspect that part of that association might be driven by these individuals taking control over a previous sexual encounter where they didn't feel they had control. And so rather than looking at that through a pathological lens and saying they're re-victimizing themselves, maybe it's that they're empowering themselves and taking control over that past trauma. Now, at the same time, I also find that people who experience sexual trauma and sexual victimization were more likely to report fantasies about passion and romance and, you know, these types of fantasies where they're being loved and cared for. And so to me, what this suggests is that different people cope with sexual trauma in very different ways. And for some people, you know, maybe they're having these fantasies where they're trying to provide some calm and reassurance, because that's what helps them get through it. For others, maybe it's that they're trying to take control over the encounter. And then one other thing I found here was that people with a history of sexual trauma also had more fantasies about emotionless sex. And so for some individuals, they might just try and strip all of the emotion out of sex and make it just about the physical act itself, so as not to open themselves up and be vulnerable to further emotional trauma. So again, I think we have very diverse coping mechanisms for how we deal with trauma.
And are you concerned that sort of these coping mechanisms, whether it be, like you said, stripping the emotion from sex or whatever it might be, are you concerned that they might sort of exacerbate any psychological sort of things that the person might be going through?
So I think that it really depends on the individual, and we need to look at what is their current mental state. And I think that different coping strategies can be effective for different people. Where it becomes an issue and where it's important to seek professional help is when you don't feel like you can get past your trauma, or where you're having a fantasy that you're feeling a lot of guilt about. So for example, I have heard from readers of my blog who have talked about how they have these consensual non-consent fantasies, but they feel really guilty about them. And some of them have a history of sexual abuse and trauma, and they feel that there's something wrong with them for sexualizing and eroticizing forced sex when they've been victimized. And so they start blaming themselves. They feel a lot of shame and embarrassment and stigma. And so in those cases where you've got that mental distress, that's where it's important to seek professional help and counseling to work through that trauma and find a way to cope that's more effective, because some people don't figure that out on their own.
Yeah. Well, obviously, I suppose it's quite hard for we all have sort of our problems, and I don't think we all necessarily deal with it in the correct way, that's for sure. So we're getting to sort of close-ish to the end of the recording. Just for the last sort of 10 minutes or so, I want to talk about something that's I think seen a big emergence recently, which is the idea of sort of pornography, especially with men, pornography usage, masturbation, negatives associated with these two things.
So there is a lot that we hear in the media about the potential dangers of porn. We hear that porn is causing young men to have erectile dysfunction. It is causing low libido. People are getting addicted to porn, and therefore they can't be aroused by in-person partner sex, or their interests are just becoming kinkier and more extreme. And you know, what you hear in the media is very different from what I see in the research, which suggests that the effects of porn are much more nuanced, and that for the most part, it's not harmful. There are certain subsets of the population for whom there are issues when it comes to regulating their pornography use, and it's causing problems in their life or their relationship. But porn is not the boogeyman that it has been made out to be. And so, for example, if we just want to look at an issue like, say, erectile dysfunction, yes, we do hear the reports about, you know, erectile dysfunction being on the rise in young men, and everybody wants to say this is the fault of porn, but this is a multifactorial model that we have to take into account, because it's not just increased availability to porn that has happened in the last two decades. We also have more people than ever taking antidepressants, which have sexual side effects. And one of them is decreases in libido and sexual arousal problems. We also have big issues with substance use and abuse and a lot of binge drinking among adolescents and young adults. We also have a lot of sexual anxiety and body anxiety. And young men who don't feel comfortable with their bodies, and so all of these factors are coming together to influence sexual response and function, and it's short-sighted to just say it's all due to porn. It's also just not scientifically accurate to say there's this one factor that is driving everything, because science never works that way. It's just not a valid argument that holds water.
Yeah, that's interesting, and I think you know, you talk about the complexity of these sort of issues. There's so many factors, and yeah, that's something that I'd never thought about. There's sort of substance abuse and alcohol, which is obviously notorious for these kind of things, and also just people just generally being unhealthy is a huge issue too. And I know I think I was listening to a podcast with Dr. Drew or something like that, and he was talking about one of his concerns. Sort of just being that the fact that porn becomes too much of an outlet for some men, right? So the point that they have sort of certain sexual desires, they want relationships, and then they have what you said, they sort of have anxiety surrounding their body, their personality, they're unhappy with themselves, and then they use porn as their only sort of sexual outlet, and it sort of separates them more and more from a sort of a normal level of dating. So for yourself, are you worried that porn, although it might not have some big correlations in terms with the specific reasons why people have erectile dysfunction and things like that, are you worried about the, I suppose, societal implications and the relationship implications of an individual?
So I think more often than not, pornography use is the symptom rather than the cause of these problems that we're talking about. And, you know, for example, if you look at men who say they are addicted to pornography, what you see in a majority of these men is moral conflicts surrounding pornography use. And so they feel bad about the porn that they're using. And one of the most interesting studies I've seen on this, where they looked at people who self-identified as porn addicts, was they asked them, how much porn are they actually consuming? And what they found was that on average, it was about 15 minutes per week. And these men feel like they're addicted to porn. Now, I think when most people think about an addiction, they don't think about something you do for 15 minutes a week.
Yeah.
And it's interesting when we say, okay, 15 minutes a week of porn, that's an addiction, but the 3 hours of TV that the average American watches per day is not an addiction, right?
That's funny.
So there's something unique about sex and masturbation and the way that we think about it. And we tend to pathologize these behaviors. We looked at them through a different lens. We hold them to a different standard. And that feeds into all of this anxiety and shame that is compounding the problem. So, you know, that's one part of the issue. The other issue is that, getting back to what you were saying, there are lots of people who have anxiety, who have depression, who have other mental health issues going on, and they don't feel confident or comfortable starting a relationship with someone. Or maybe they're in a relationship, but they don't really know how to deal with the issues they're experiencing. And so porn can become this substitute for intimacy or a substitute for sexual gratification. But in that case, porn is the symptom, right? It's not the cause of the issue. Mm-hmm. And so this is where all of the porn addiction and sex addiction treatment programs get things wrong, is that they're treating the symptom rather than the cause.
Okay.
So we need to go back in these cases and look at, well, what was it that was driving this behavior in the first place? And it might just be, let's treat the anxiety disorder. Let's treat the mood disorder. Mm. Let's work on social self-confidence, right? And so by addressing those things, we're really getting at the root of the issue.
I find that quite funny, just sort of how I suppose bad humans are at analyzing risk, judging risk and things like that. That, yeah, you, just like you said, there's sort of 15 minutes of porn usage and people sort of don't blink an eye about the three series of Netflix that they just finished over the last week. You know, that they could be much more of an issue. Okay, so sort of in the last 5 minutes, I always like to ask sort of academics, just such as yourself, who are in a good position to sort of answer the question, kind of like the magic wand scenario, right? And for yourself, it's good to sort of ask in two different perspectives, the perspective of general individuals such as myself, and also the perspective of the government and of jurisdiction and things like that. What would you like to see different for society as a whole and people, whether it's the way that they think, the things that they do, and what would you like to see different in terms of legislation or even research?
So I'm guessing I'm going to give a similar answer to what Kristen did, because
potentially
Kristen and I are colleagues at the Kinsey Institute, and we have both taught study abroad courses in Amsterdam. And in fact, we've both been over there together teaching our courses at the same time, and we've guest lectured for each other.
Just don't answer. I'll just put in Kristen's answer.
Yeah. So let's look at the Dutch model of sex education, because they've got things right. They teach students what they need to know about sex, including the correct anatomical names for their body parts. They teach them sexual communication skills. And the outcome is that they have the lowest rates of teen STIs and abortions and pregnancies in the industrialized world. So I think there's a lot that we can do in this country to improve our sexual health outcomes just by looking at what other people in the world are doing and what is working and what isn't. And that can very much inform the types of laws that we need to pass at the federal level, and also the kind of action that we need to take at the local level with school boards in terms of what is the content of a sex education curriculum, what should that look like.
Okay. I mean, it was actually quite different
than
what Chris has said. And you know, it was a good summary. So you know, hats off to you for although having the same ideas, sort of portraying it in a different manner. Okay, Justin, I really appreciate you spending the time, especially like you said, you've got a few podcasts and recordings to have, and I hope I didn't ask just exactly the same questions everyone else will ask, because that will get tiresome for you quite quickly, I imagine.
No, and I love when people ask me different questions and when it's not the same thing every time.
Of course.
So, you know, thanks for doing a deep dive there. I appreciate it.
No problem at all. So thanks for your time, Justin. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
If you enjoyed this episode of the podcast, please subscribe to us. Go to any of our social media accounts or website. Tell your friends, tell your grandparents. Do anything you can do in your power to help us out, because it will allow us to continue doing this podcast for everybody, which we greatly appreciate. Thank you for the support, and see you next time.